Everyone, thank you for coming to what I genuinely believe to be the most important panel of the day. To the chagrin of my fellow panelists, I'm an ESG true believer. I bike commute. I'm a weekday vegetarian. I live this stuff, and I think our industry needs to as well. Let me just start by saying that the doomsday clock run by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists right now includes climate risk as part of the reason why the world is 100 seconds to midnight, which in comparison to where the doomsday clock was with the Cuban Missile Crisis should be incredibly alarming. So with that in mind, I'll ask each panelist to introduce themselves and give a very brief view on their ESG journey that's brought them to this panel. And just remind you that if it's 100 seconds to midnight, then we sure as hell should act like it, shouldn't we? So Tanya, if you'd like to start.
Sure. Hi, I'm Tanya Waters. I'm a VP at Neuberger Berman. I joined the firm in 2019 to manage IR for the ILS team. And Neuberger Berman is a global asset manager with $450 billion in AUM today across three core platforms: equities, fixed income, and alternatives. ILS falls in the alternatives bucket. We're about $3 billion today. And we have a team of 11 across three offices: Bermuda, New York, and London. Our ESG journey, I'll start with the firm because we've actually been active participants since 1989 when we launched our first dedicated ESG integrated strategy. Since then, we've made tremendous strides in the space. And today, actually, 80% of our assets are invested in dedicated ESG integrated strategies. So huge accomplishment for the firm and a high priority for us. For the ILS team, we've been working with our dedicated ESG team for the last 12 months. The firm really leaves it to the individual teams to do the research themselves and determine what's applicable to our asset class and how best to integrate that into our ESG or into our underwriting process. So that's been our journey so far, and happy to share insights today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Craig Hupper from TransRe. Delighted to be here. See everybody on the panel. Just by way of brief introduction, TransRe is an approximately $5 billion equity global reinsurance company, writes practically all lines of business around the world, and owned by Allegheny Corporation, which is a publicly held U.S.-based, and this will be important, I think, in some of our further discussions, U.S.-based holding company. Our ESG journey began about a dozen years ago through a variety of initiatives within the organization. Not least, we have an emerging risk process within our global risk management framework, and climate change has been on the list of emerging risks for that period of time. We've issued papers, hosted a series of seminars with experts, incorporated the best view of climate science into our assessment of some of the CAT models for property CAT and so forth. And so done that on sort of an informal basis for the last decade or so. Over the last couple of years, it became clear that ESG, and particularly climate risk considerations, were becoming just table stakes for any company that wanted to be taken seriously, and particularly for publicly traded organizations. And so we amped up our ESG efforts through a variety of increases in resource allocations. We formed a task force on climate change, which I headed up starting about 3 years ago. That later morphed to be a task force on ESG to incorporate other social and governance issues as well. But again, the emphasis primarily on climate risk. And in the last year, just about last July, a colleague of mine with a CAT underwriting background, we were named to head up a new ESG function within the organization. Our mandate is broad, but broadly speaking, it is to develop and implement an ESG framework throughout the company's operations. And that includes underwriting, investments, the operational side of things, and all the other things a reinsurance company does. And I'm sure we can get into that as helpful.
Thank you.
Lo presento Lorenzo.
Grazie, Tom.
Prego.
So, Lorenzo Volpi, I'm one of the managing partners of Leadenhall Capital Partners, which has its headquarters in London. We have an office in Bermuda, and we have also we have a joint venture with Mitsui Sumitomo Insurance. We've been around since 2008. We have more than $6.1 billion of assets. We invest both in non-life, but also in life insurance. Obviously, we deal only with institutional investors. There's been a high demand, from investors for ESG products or better understanding of what asset managers can do to basically actively promote, ESG criteria within the underwriting of our asset class. So, I'm the person in charge of, client relationship fundraising. So for me, it's always been very important, and probably started back 7 years ago. I remember going to a strategic offsite with a slide which said, okay, sustainability and ESG, and brought it to my partners and said, guys, this is something that we really need to take seriously. And over the years, things have evolved, of course. There's always been a big question marks in terms of, qualitative versus quantitative aspects of ESG for insurance. One thing I always say to investors is, the good news is insurance in terms of carbon emissions is way lower than an equity of a manufacturing company. So the starting point is already very strong for us. And
So if we talk about the challenges of mining the lithium that goes into cell phones.
I think maybe just to reconnect.
Sorry, so, we're off now.
It's okay. So obviously there are different levels when you work in an asset manager that you need to think about when you look at ESG. And first of all, you have to think, okay, where are we domiciled in terms of our headquarters? Because we are UK. So what is the UK government doing? Is it aligning to other countries around the world? And of course, in the UK, we have the Task Force for Climate Change. And this actually makes it a legal requirement for a lot of the investors to actually report what the carbon emissions are. And the legal requirement, so it's not a nice to have, it's a must have, which means that now you get inquiries from UK pension funds saying, and those that actually have more than $5 billion are required to do that before year end. They say, okay, you need to tell me all your investments, what are the emissions you cause. And that obviously comes back to us. Then there is a level of where are your funds domiciled. So if your funds are domiciled in Europe, then you have to think about the UN principles. You have to think about the SDR. So our funds are Article 8, for example, which means that you need to promote again sustainability and ESG. We can't be in this sector an impact investment fund because we're not investing in renewables. And then there is another level, which is you have to think about your investors, and your investors are all around the world. So for us over the last 5 years, the real challenge has been, okay, how many associations there are out there that actually are looking at ESG, how many consultancy firms pushing it, and what are the requirements that each of these associations are asking for, whether it's in Japan, in Australia, in New Zealand, in the US, or in Europe. And you want to think about, okay, which are the credible ones you need to work with. And I think the real work that we need to do is rather than listening about what the hurdles are, is to be proactive and pushing and say, okay, what can we do to actually make sure that we find the answers that other asset classes, which are the main traditional, the obvious one are equity, fixed income, and real estate when we think about carbon emissions, how do we do it with insurance?
I'd like to jump off on that. So before we talk to about what specifically we will do, one of the things that you were just mentioning and that we've all spoken about a little bit is the fact that we've got two pressures coming on the industry for ESG, right? You've got, and I've been hearing this for several years now from the ILS market, end investors who insist on something better and something tangible in terms of ESG from the asset class, where we have been falling short. And on the other hand, you've got internal considerations, be they a commitment to not changing or evolving and doing things as an industry the way we always have, fear of change, or even the fear of eroded returns by committing to ESG relative to what we make right now. So you've got a whole lot of pressure coming from the investor side saying, go do something. You've got a whole lot of pressure potentially coming from the inside and more traditional parts of either your organization or the industry saying, don't change a thing. And now we're kind of caught in this vice, right? So I'm curious to understand, like, how do you deal with these dual pressures? And I know I'm merging two of the questions of, you know, hey, how do you answer investor questions and how do you deal with barriers to progress? But it really does create a squeeze, right? So how are you seeing that manifest and how are you responding to that?
Yeah, you know, there is an element of making sure that obviously, yeah, for example, the protection gap, right? Everyone talks about it. You have micro insurance, you have a number of areas where we would love to basically support by providing the right capacity. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be part of the team that structured the CRIF, right, the Caribbean Insurance Facility. And at the time, for me it was amazing just to think that we could structure something for all the Caribbean islands that could provide immediate payment post-natural disasters and also, you know, bring in the World Bank in the first deal. That was already, part, now it goes back 14 years, so, yeah. That was already ahead of the game. But then you also need to think about the investors, right, and say, okay, but are you paid enough for those type of risk? I mean, the element of diversification is always good because the obvious selling point has always been, well, if you bring more to the market, which it doesn't correlate to the rest, of the portfolio, then it's great for the portfolio, but at the same time, you want to be paid for. And so, I would lie if I say that we go for everything. We definitely want to support it, but at the end of the day, we need to deliver the right returns to the investors.
Could I just pick up on sort of an illusion or an inference maybe in your question? And I think you're touching on something really important within ESG, and it's the question about whether ESG is ultimately consistent with fiduciary obligations. I mean, so I mentioned our parent company, U.S. domiciled, headquartered in Delaware. Delaware corporation law is, pretty clear about the obligations of managers, to act in their owners' best interests. And so we have this conversation a lot about, okay, whatever your personal views might be, you have this obligation. Okay, so can you structure an ESG-friendly approach that is consistent with those fiduciary obligations and, in fact, supportive of those? And it's fascinating. We talk to different investors around the world, and there's a whole spectrum of approaches on this. We've talked to some European investors, for example, who, they just believe, ESG, emphasis on sustainability and resilience, these are absolutely core factors and completely supportive of the investment thesis. I mean, they think ESG investing is successful and good investing. I think the view in North America, well, the U.S. view, I think the jury is much more still out on that question. Yeah. ESG is viewed as sort of, a drag on performance. It's inflationary. There are, ESG-friendly opportunities out there, but, they're sort of few and far between. And so we in the industry are trying to resolve that situation.
It's interesting that we've got this tension between short-term financial performance, which is critical to demonstrating that you're doing your job, but the thought that you're risking future short-term financial performance by neglecting some of these issues. And this seems to be the essential tension within the industry, right? How do we, make sure that we can generate long-term return or returns over the long term while managing that with, not eroding our returns for something that may or may not be a real risk, right?
Yeah, so, but then there is another element, right? I mean, investors don't want just to hear about how you're going to do it for your portfolio. Investors want also to hear about you as a company, whether you really marry the vision by thinking about your building, the building you lease. What are you doing? So we got to the point to discuss with the management company of the building to look at the bills to discover, well, we actually moved into a building that is energy, net zero, because they basically plant trees in Kent, for example. And I know you're skeptical about it, but, helps, because at least, we get a couple of bills, electricity and gas, that says net zero bills, and investors like it. There is an element of training within your company. So now we're not a big company, we're only 31 people, but at least, talking to everyone and discuss the, how they come to the office, for example, what are the facilities in the building to allow them to cycle in, or, things like that. I mean, investors want to see that you marry the vision, right? So it's not just portfolio, it's also you as a company. Are you promoting it? How you do it?
Yeah. So I'd like to shift back to the product for a second. I agree, right? You've got to look at everything you do as a company and how you perform. But when it comes to the product itself, Tanya, you said something interesting the other day about responsiveness and impact of the product, right? So if you're building an ESG-friendly product, we think about, things like reduction in source risk or reduction in bad stuff up front. But what else do you think an instrument would need to do in order to demonstrate some sort of ESG value?
We focus on index-based event link securities like ILWs and parametrics. That's the core of our business. And what we look for and what we think is inherent within ESG is well-modeled data, transparency, and then quick payouts, getting the proceeds to the communities that need it most after a disaster. So I think in order to progress ESG initiatives, we really need to look at how we can promote risk transfer solutions that get the money to the people that need it as fast as possible.
And to Lorenzo's point about looking at the company behind these things, if you're trading ILWs, I ride my bike to work. So check that box. It's an important point you mentioned on insurance, though. So I just wrapped up some research on insured losses in Ukraine from the conflict. And over the past year, the U.S. has injected $1 billion of foreign aid into Ukraine. Meanwhile, our working estimate right now for insured losses net of aviation leasing is potentially around $13 to $14 billion. So 14 times the size of U.S. aid to Ukraine is the projected near-term impact of the insurance industry's impact of capital into a community that's going to need it to recover quickly. So keep in mind, again, we talk about the social mission and the promise to pay as an industry. These are probably the biggest social impact levers we have. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, if I could just, not to make too much of a plug for the reinsurance business and the ILS community as well. I mean, look, insurance and risk transfer exists to support resilient communities and to promote resilient communities. I mean, I'd much rather be in this business promoting ESG than, an opioid manufacturer, tobacco maker, certain weapon systems, although apparently some people are saying that's now part of the arsenal of democracy and ESG friendly. But, ESG is complicated.
It is, but I'm not about to go Second Amendment on it.
Okay. But my point is this industry has a very favorable story to tell. And it exists for a socially valid reason, which I think we should all be proud of. And I think it makes our journey, gives us a leg up starting the ESG journey.
Actually, to your point, Greg, when you talk about tobacco and the rest, it just reminds me that, the first approach from investors was what I call the negative filter approach. Right. So going back probably starting 4 years ago, we started receiving tons of questionnaires and it was just tick the box and say, okay, you're not underwriting all this risk, which to be honest, we scratch our head at the beginning thinking, okay, how do we make really 100% sure that we're not underwriting those risks, right? So, and that's when we started asking the seeding companies and the brokers, for certain reporting. And then we thought, okay, hang on a second, are we ahead of the game here, and people will tell us that they don't want to answer, and that means that they won't see it as the risk, which is the other issue. Together with when you price climate change, we all think great opportunity, climate change, short term risk 1 year in terms of they're all over the portfolio, but at the same time, you know, if you start, we do a lot of work there, right, in terms of stressing it with temperatures, frequency, and so on. But then, you know, how real it is. You go and discuss it. So unless they're all industries coming together and agrees that you should load for certain aspects of the risk, then you become adverse selected, right? Because people will simply say, well, there is enough capacity. Why should I give it to Leden or like go for someone else that is going to price at the lower? So there is the, you know, the ideal situation versus the reality, right? Yeah. But then we move from the negative filter approach to actually, okay, but we really need now to know, you know, whether you have an underwriting process there where you give certain values or criteria of scoring, right? So for car bonds, you know, we have this white, amber, and black, and then we have to write down and say, okay, for each bond, you know, why we like it, why don't we like it, and if we think about ESG criteria, you know, how we classify all this, which of course, you know, governance is the easiest because, you know, you can like or dislike a company for many reasons. You just write some, you know, some comments and that's it. But then when you start thinking about how you quantify the actual you know, carbon emissions, so we looked at all the insurance companies and the ones that actually report on that. And of course, the way that insurance companies, if you invest in the equity of an insurance company, the way that the carbon emissions are you know, applied there is just on their capital, right? So they look at the debt and equity. So then you think, okay, hang on a second, but reinsurance is a form of capital, but you know, how do I apply that to debt and equity? And am I double counting? And then now I actually read a paper like last week from like a few you know, American companies, which I was quite surprised about because I thought Europe was you know, way more focused on the theme than the US, at least on the insurance side, on the cedent side. And then, you know, there was this formula saying, well, actually you should look at the underlying exposures and then see what the carbon emissions are for the underlying exposures and then multiply that to the basically your share within the insurance treaty and, you know, what the contribution is as a percentage of the premium. So, and they accept the double counting. So that meant, okay, finally we have something that we can maybe report to our investors, which is also quantitative, is not just qualitative. And the funny thing is, you know, you meet some of the consultants and some are more vocal than others, and they look at all your slides and they say, oh, okay, these are, you know, these are obvious, right? Yeah, you are a member of the Standard Board of Alternative Investments and you push that, and you are a member of this institutional investors group for climate change, and you are a member of this other organization and you list, you know, everything that you're doing. But how do you really make an impact and how do you differentiate yourself from the others? And I think that's, you know, the real challenge that we face, right?
You know, I feel pretty strongly about that, right? You know, nobody's going to paperwork their way to cleaning up the environment. I mean, it's nice to document, but we need to, if we're going to document something, it's got to be impact, right? So one of the frustrations I've had in this industry for ESG for a while now is that we've taken credit for being an ESG industry because we write CAT, right? So CAT is climate change. Climate change means there's going to be more CAT, so we're going to write more CAT reinsurance, CAT bonds, and maybe we'll price for climate change. So now we're pricing for climate change in this increasing amount of catastrophe activity, which really just means that things are getting worse and we're charging for it. So one option, of course, is we just charge more for climate change until there's no more climate left. And then, you know, ultimately nobody's going to be around to collect the claim anyway. You know, or we can implement some tangible measures. What are you hearing? I mean, what ideas are you hearing out there for things we can do?
I feel like we need to differentiate between, like there's two ways to address climate change. There's mitigating our effect on the climate, and then there's adapting to the natural catastrophes from climate change, which is what you're talking about. And like that's, given like that we're protection providers, I mean, that's where we fall is in the ladder. I think we have to look at how we can just do that better including quick payouts. But also, I think like supporting other ILS participants like modeling agencies or brokers to expand the database, the modeling database, and quantify the risks in the regions that are underserved, but that you know have natural catastrophes and aren't protected. And I think we also need to quantify the risks beyond US hurricanes, you know, and look like wildfire is a secondary peril, but that's increasing every single year. It's getting worse and worse. So I think, you know, doing things like that can go beyond just pricing for climate change.
So a really good point. So just on wildfires, in 2016, Fort Mac became the largest insured loss we had from wildfire for the US or Canada. And it is no longer in the top five. So this once in a lifetime after that Fort Mac loss, some folks in this room, certainly some in the industry, were saying it was a one-off, it'll never happen again, this is ridiculous. Yeah, 2017 hits, and you're right, a loss year that small from wildfire never would happen again.
Yeah, but that's where, you know, as a sector, you learn your lessons as well, right? It's part of human being and every sector.
We hope to.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But I think the trend across ILS managers has been the same, right? Try to, you know, mitigate the risk around secondary perils or the less or the more difficult to model perils or, you know, make a judgment of whether the contribution to expected loss for that secondary peril is adequately compensated in the program, you know, stay away for frequency if you can. But of course, that's easy when, you know, capital is not flowing in, right? As soon as we'll see more capital hopefully coming in, I mean, we are always, I mean, very, very positive, I hope, about it, because we can't deny the, you know, the benefits of the asset class within the wider portfolio location. Then probably we will have learned again more. I mean, the good thing about what happened is that it gave us a lot of data points. It gave us a lot of things to discuss with investors. I mean, I heard, you know, a bit of disappointment this morning during the different sessions. But in reality, you know, what I always say is, well, if you talk in a very transparent and honest way to your investors before they invest and you tell them that they are exposed to all natural perils, it means that they are exposed to all natural perils. So there are no surprises. And then, you know, when the events occur, then you can say, look, you're right, this, you know, never happened before. But we always discuss about the fact that until, you know, 2017, this was not a free lunch. Sooner or later, something would have happened. And hopefully we'll go back to a normalized situation as well, right? But also when you look at the carbon market, for example, on a standalone basis, I was reading a research from Lane Financial, and it was showing that when you look at the actual expected loss over the last 10 years versus the actual losses suffered from the carbon market, I mean, the expected loss has been way lower than, you know. So in a way, it's true that, you know, carbons, more primary perils, you know, model perils and so on. But that shows that, you know, the premium has been there and that the market has behaved, right? So.
Can I just...
You don't have to ask. You're up here for a reason. No. You can speak. I mean, no, this is literally why we want you on stage.
No, I'm channeling my internal James Lee. James, in one of the programs this morning, sort of turned around and asked the moderator. And so is your question about sort of what's the way society addresses climate risk and other ESG issues optimally? And what's the role of private industry versus the public sector?
So... No, I'm being far more targeted. I think society has much to figure out. I think governments have a lot to figure out, but I don't think that lets us off the hook. And you know, my sense is that we can talk about who should lead, but ultimately the global community, right, the global community of governments is inherently anarchic. So, it is. There may be some agreement through conventions or NGOs,
sure,
or like the UN.
Difficult, yeah.
But those are all voluntary in itself. So any retraction from an anarchic environment is strictly voluntary and can be withdrawn at any time. So the interstate environment is anarchic. And when you're looking at that, so how does the state take a leadership position in that environment? In an anarchic environment, it would have to be from self-interest. In an ordered or structured or a hybrid environment, which is what we have, it would have to be with at least some consent from other states. And the one thing we've learned is that as a global society, we're not really good at figuring that out. So somebody's got to go first. And we're now in an environment where we've got some non-state actors, particularly corporations, that are far larger than some major state actors. So, and then you've got other still large organizations like those represented in this room and our various end clients and investors who are large and influential as well. So the way I see it, there is a broad collection of who could go first on any number of incremental measures. You know, the notion of a large transformational one fell swoop solution to all of this, no. There's not going to be any single pact through which we attain world common sense on climate. But are there things that industries or companies could do to make their contribution and either encourage or compel others in that business environment to act? Absolutely. The pressure provided by some end investors, for ESG solutions, I think, is indicative of that, right? We have the capital. We want to deploy it. We want to deploy it in a way that is reflective of long-term risk management practices because, you know, if I've got a 50-year investment horizon, I can't just worry quarter to quarter. I need to know that my X percent is going to be there in, you know, 2047 just as it is today. So I think that there's certainly plenty of control, influence, incentive, and opportunity in our corner of the commercial community to affect positive change. And when you think about the amount of change we've seen over the past 30, 40 years, it gives you a sense of just how much volatility can be present socially. So if we add environmental volatility to the mix and we have an opportunity to pull levers today to protect the potential for future returns, we should be doing so. That to me just seems like an opportunity not just to lead, but also to affect a competitive advantage for long-term consistent returns, rather than taking short-term measures that are going to put climate at risk, given that climate is the primary driver of the things, to Tanya's point, that our industry has to protect against.
Look, I think I should probably provide a disclaimer. I probably should have done this up front to keep my general counsel from breathing down my neck. But, so whatever I say is, you know, my personal opinion rather than TransRe's. But look, I think the private sector obviously has a huge role to play in this. But I mean, like you said something about self-interest a minute ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll speak to the U.S. model. I mean, you know, we're capitalists. We're privately held. You know, we operate in our owner's interests. You know, we comply with all applicable laws. We want to be good corporate citizens. Mm-hmm. We inherently, and you know, just at our core, we are thinking about the long term.
I get it. We will comply with anything we're required to comply to, but otherwise we'll be there to maximize shareholder value.
No, I'm totally
with you.
The problem is,
we're going to also work diligently to affect any barriers we can to increased reporting requirements. Not any, but we may act to manage the risk of increased compliance or reporting obligations because they erode returns. And honestly, I'm not talking about you guys or my own company, but I get it. You know, as part of that fiduciary responsibility, you run into certain tensions that you have to sort out.
Sure.
And you know, when it comes to the role of compliance as incentive, yes, you know, if you're told you have to do something, that makes it a lot easier. You know, on the other hand, if you can find a way to take positive, effective, and affirmative action now, such that future regulation isn't necessary, all the better, because you're now in the driver's seat of defining your own.
You want to have enlightened self-interest. Look, you need to be able to. You're only going to achieve incremental or marginal change by acting individually. There needs to be a framework for this. Now, again, disclaiming, you know, my personal view. Now, I'd love to see something like a carbon tax put in. I mean, to incorporate, you know, I'm under no illusions about how realistic that is, particularly in the short term. But we need to embed these considerations in, you know, the billions of individual decisions that get made every day across the planet. And climate risk has been described as sort of the mother of all externalities. I mean, there are plenty of other examples of, like, pollution is another externality. Yeah. Well, government had an important role to play in cleaning up the environment here in the U.S. in the last 50 years. You know, you'd like to see something like that, you know, with the private sector participating, supporting that. But I think it's not realistic to expect the public sector to, you know, solve the problem. The private sector to solve the problem without an overarching public framework within which it operates.
You need both. Yeah. Go ahead, Lorenzo.
I agree, to be honest. I mean, you need the public sector and the government first to push, and then the private sector, you know, we're here then to capitalize as well and make money and, do whatever we can. I think it's, you know, the public sector and the government gives the awareness for the entire population, right? Like, and when I think about sustainability, I always think about my kids, right? And I think the fact that they actually, you know, very young, at school, they probably learned more than me about sustainability and ESG, right? Mm-hmm. So actually they came back home and said, oh, Dad, you shouldn't do that. I'm like, oh, really? And, oh, Dad, look at that. We should help. Ah, okay. And
you clearly respond to demands for compliance.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but that's the eye-opener, right? Because at the end of the day, it's going to be their world soon. But unless you have a government and the education sector that actually are pushing in a certain direction, I mean, in the U.S., you know, there's a classic example. Until Trump, was the president, I don't think anyone really cared about ESG and sustainability, right? And so then things have changed. And I can also see from an investor standpoint, I mean, when I think about New Zealand, Japan, Europe, and Switzerland, there has always been a strong focus and push. The U.S. now, there are some, retirement schemes that obviously are pushing as well, but you also meet a lot of investors that don't really care, okay? They just say, look, you have a couple of slides of ESG, Lorenzo. Let's just skip those.
Can I turn around to my fellow panelists, investors who care or don't care? I mean, do your investors, is it easier for investors to care about this when, you're delivering above market performance for them? I mean, does this become an issue when you're doing well or not doing well? Or a theoretical other fund, not your own?
I don't think you can sell the track record of a fund now based on ESG, right?
Right.
I think it's more something for the future. I mean, we're all working toward that. But yeah. So if I tell my investor that the reason why we did well is because we have an ESG committee of 6 people, it's going to laugh. Okay, so
you've got the right 6 people.
You don't have enough people.
No, yes, and you have the right 6 people. So yeah, that's
exactly.
The selling point.
Yeah. Exactly. They're going to call the bullshit straight away, right? So it's not. But the answer is.
But will your investors care about ESG if you're not delivering an acceptable risk-adjusted reward?
I mean, firm-wide, we're seeing over 50% of our RFPs have an ESG section included. Okay. So I do think that it is a really important consideration that's only going to continue to grow. Back to your point, Lorenzo, where you were saying like investors care about what the firm is doing from an ESG perspective and how they're making an impact. Like, I think what Neuberger does great is that they have been doing this since 1989, like I mentioned, but aside from the firm efforts, they've made a commitment at every single level of the organization. So we have a dedicated board of directors that oversees our climate-related enterprise risk and the firm's approach to climate-related risks and opportunities. And then we have like senior management who works with our head of ESG to make sure that we have the appropriate climate expertise and analytical capabilities to support the individual investment teams who really, back to your point about making influence on an individual level, each investment team has to decide after doing the research, like what's the best way to integrate it into the investment process so that each investment that we're making has gone through some kind of consideration towards ESG. And that is going to be something that lasts long term in the portfolio.
It's a good point. Yeah. What I'd probably add, you've mentioned, and you'll be next, don't worry, is, to Craig, your point, you have to do your job, right? Is someone going to say, you're giving me sub-market returns, but at least you're saving the polar bears?
No. But they are going to say, we expect you to give us sufficient returns, and we expect you to save the polar bears. You know, I don't think you can go one or the other. I think what we need to think about is the extent to which end investors, for example, will insist on a certain type of return and a certain type of ESG commitment, which I think, Lorenzo, to your point about needing to be kind of communicative early on, I think that all falls into that discussion.
But I do believe that in future there will be investors that will care less about track record and more about the polar bear.
As the world gets scarier.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. As you know, Nevada
it could
becomes
be just philanthropist. You know, you have to find the right niche. But I think we'll find those investors.
And as the climate issue becomes more urgent. So you've got a question. We're going to need to get a microphone to you. I learned the hard way during the last session when I asked my question. All right, sir, fire away.
Thank you. Well, I think Lorenzo made a great point that micro insurance could be a very powerful tool to help spread the ability of people to survive disasters. Yeah. And Tanya made the point that people outside the United States also need to be protected for hurricanes and earthquakes. As a non-insurer, I'm a cat modeler, it seems to me that the most powerful opportunity in this community for ESG is simply not insuring the producers of fossil fuels.
I would disagree with that. And I've put a lot of thought into this. So if you withdraw insurance protection from some of these organizations, a few things happen. First off, when they wind up with industrial accidents or other types of severe loss events that are insured, it's the end worker who's going to suffer, right? If you've got no insurance controls, you'll have fatalities on the job, you will have cover-ups, you'll have environmental damage with no accountability and no means of capital injection post-event for remediation. Additionally, you'll find, I bet, pockets of insurance industry that will specialize in insuring them, which would then perpetuate the problem. So I don't think not insuring them helps, and I don't think withdrawing from those classes of business necessarily helps. What I'd like, I mean, just, you know, who am I except, you know, the PCS guy from Jersey, but, you know, in my mind, what gets interesting is if you create runoff style facilities for some of these legacy fossil fuel risks. You know, if you're an insurer right now and you've got, let's say, fossil fuel D&O on your books, if you can do some sort of loss portfolio transfer to a purpose-built fund that will run those off over time and help fossil fuel industries filter that risk out of the business and leave room for alternatives to fossil fuels to grow, which I think is crucial not just for the environment, but also issues such as national security and energy security. A smooth, organized, financially appropriate transition, you know, done actuarially well. You know, imagine a loss portfolio transfer market that can actually run smoothly. That, to me, is the ideal situation. I think if you go cold turkey, it becomes not just financially disruptive to the insureds, but also could become physically threatening to the communities that rely on them. Microinsurance, I love, by the way. I think there are 4 billion people in this world who've hit the target market for microinsurance. And what's crazy is if you're putting a year's wages under the mattress, it's exposed to physical risk, it's exposed to post-cat currency volatility and inflation risk. But if you actually have insurance instead of that, that capital can be deployed into the community, send a kid to school, you know, hire people to work on your farm, and actually create a middle class more quickly, more reliably, and more sustainably. Any other questions? Let's just pop right into it. We'll talk between questions, but come on, we got one in the back here. Sorry to make you walk, Steve.
Hi, thanks. Jim LaMunya with CFAN. I'm wondering if there's a question for any of the panelists. Is there a way to verify when a certain ESG initiative or policy has been a success? And is there enough of a track record that's been built up where we can point to success stories and say, gee, that worked, we ought to do more of it, whether it's insurance or any other industry?
What do you guys think? I think it's a success when it's renewed. I've got a few ideas, but I want to defer to you guys. Yeah.
For us, obviously, as we write notes about, within the investment committee on the various investments, if we excluded a certain investment based governance is the easiest one, right? And then the bond triggers, then we can claim that we actually apply the policy and that proved that it was beneficial to the investors. So that's a very simple example, right?
So, Jim, I got two responses. I don't know if they're answers, but let me take a shot. I guess I'd make an observation. So there are competing, there are plenty of third-party providers out there who are happy to provide ESG ratings on typically investments in companies, not so much on insurance. One of the issues, though, and that's, maybe that's a metric of success, at least you can manage or measure against what these service providers give you, but one of the issues is just that, two different service providers. The classic example is Tesla. One of the companies, one of the well-known rating companies, says Tesla is ESG friendly and great because it's electric cars and that's the future. Another well-known rating agency says it's Tesla is terrible because its CEO is volatile and has terrible governance and runs off buying solar companies and social media feeds, on a whim and stuff, and it's opaque and impenetrable. So that's complicating some of this. I think there was a question related to this on microinsurance. And again, it's not intended to be a shameless plug, we're welcome to have others. So we were a founding member of a consortium called Blue Marble Microinsurance, which is designed to bring micro lending model, like the Grameen Bank was the sort of model for this venture, to bring insurance to Colombian coffee farmers and maize farmers in Kenya and so forth, largely on a parametric basis. So this ties in a lot with this morning's discussion about how do we find new ventures in ILS, how do we close the protection gap? I mean, I think this is the kind of thing where we can really add some value. Maybe that's a success measure. Providing a profitable business opportunity, but really building some resilience and social protection to folks in underserved communities who just have never had this before. It's slow going, though, but I think it's very worth investing in.
I'm actually going to steal one of Joan Lamb-Tennant's old microinsurance success stories.
So Joan was great.
Joan was the founding CEO of Blue Marble, and years ago I was her ghostwriter. So she was telling me about a microinsurance program in Pakistan a while back. Year one, it was hard going, because you think, right, the biggest problem in insurance is distribution. And I know the data geeks and so forth hate hearing that, but the real problem is selling, right? Because what are you doing? You're taking something that doesn't exist and going to them, say, hey, you know what? Give me some cash now. I don't have a thing to give you. But when stuff goes wrong, I'll totally come back and give you 20 times that. The New Yorker in me does not like that model. So now you go to a part of the world with very low levels of financial literacy where asking for even a couple of bucks, that's a big decision, right? So you go to some of these marginalized communities and you try to sell them microinsurance. First year doesn't go well, right? So you had year one, you had some losses. The only people who renewed their policies with this program in year two were the folks who had losses year one. You don't have to be a fantastic underwriter, right, to understand that this is a problem. They stuck with it, said, you know what? We're gonna write these programs, we're gonna write effectively the worst of the worst, only the guys who had losses. And again, paid some claims. And what happened year three? Distribution was a lot easier. Because now you had a certain amount of proof, social proof and financial proof, A, that the program worked, and B, that you were going to stick with it. And by year four, the program was wildly profitable. So what does this tell me? The measure of success is how many people come back when you renew and how many companies are willing to renew when going gets tough. Yeah, so you've got to take a long-term view of this. You've got to be willing to take your lumps along the way. But if you're talking about a market of 4 billion people, which, when it's successful,
creates a much larger market of 4 billion people. The success of microinsurance is when those same insureds are going to be buying liability programs because they've got some assets to protect. Once they're as litigious as the U.S., microinsurance will have done its job.
Yeah, but that's why you need government intervention and backup, right? So when, because you know, what you described was exactly the hurdle that I had when I was structuring the CRIF. So the whole idea was, okay, it's obvious that there are these Caribbean islands that need protection for hurricane and earthquake. And then we thought, okay, I'm going to second, let's look at the debt. It's the World Bank that provides the debt. So that's when we thought, okay, we need to set up a mutual insurance company because this government will never pay, to protect themselves. Okay. So if the government doesn't want to protect themselves, think about the individuals on the land. And that's when the World Bank said, okay, it's a good idea, actually, so we can call some donor countries. And that's what they did. So they called, in that case, it was Canada, France, and Japan. And that money was used to actually capitalize the mutual insurance company. And then, they would buy reinsurance on top of that. But that's, if it doesn't come from the government, then it's difficult for the people, to actually...
Extremely. Yeah, and the best proof of that is where you see most U.S. insurance penetration, right? How many states require you to have auto insurance if you're going to drive a car? There may be some voluntary purchasing excess, the statutory requirements, but a lot of that penetration comes from an insurance requirement. So we'll keep talking. Someone raise a hand while you say your next bit.
No, there is also an element of how much protection you want to buy, right? So in that case... And the reason is very simple. You have the event, so at the government level, you bought protection, but then you realize that the disaster is way bigger than the actual losses, that they actually cover. And so, of course, the media starts making a lot of noise, and they say, hang on a second, we just really realized that Haiti only bought $5 million of protection when the economic loss is way bigger, right? And so there are also those sorts of elements to be taken into account.
There are, yeah, and when you look at societal economic security manifesting in those situations.
Yeah, reputation risk,
Yeah, and not to mention, economic stability and state stability ultimately requires the easy flow of capital post-disasters. If you look at under-penetration in Haiti and the attendant political stability issues they have, it's not entirely an accident. I mean, there are other factors involved in that relationship, other intervening factors. But it's still very much the case that a stable economic environment produces a stable political environment, which reinforces a safe societal environment. So we got time for another question here. I know someone's got something. I mean, please don't make this feel like an actuarial conference.
Show some excitement for ESG.
Yeah, seriously.
I've got a question for you.
All right.
So, with ESG and climate, it's obviously a massive topic. We write about it all the time. But the reason I call this responsible is really about what is it that investors are coming to you for, and I guess this is for the managers, but to the industry for. Are they just coming for an asset class that you've managed to score your way through to turn portfolios into something that's more ESG compliant? Or are they coming to you asking for something that is risk management and risk capital to help the world through a climate transition, which seems like a much more sales-focused, responsible approach to...
Yeah, I think it's across the board, right?
You're getting it from both sides.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, that's, investors really, grill you on every aspect. I mean, that's, sometimes actually, you read a question and you think, hang on a second, I think I've already addressed that question, 10 pages earlier, and how do we do it? How do we do it in the right way without crossing them? But definitely both. I mean, obviously they look at and some of them, obviously, you have different investors, different individuals within the those investors with different views as well, right? So some of them take it very seriously. Some of them say, okay, I really need to do this for compliance reason because the UK government now is asking us to do it, but I still don't know how you guys are going to deliver this. Can we actually apply this to your asset class, what you're doing? But then there is consensus about the fact that if, as a manager, you show that you're serious about it and you are doing everything you can, to provide a compelling answer, then, you can buy some time, let's say, right? Say, look, you know, this is what we're trying to achieve. This is how we do it, whether it's a rating, whether it's, you know, the infrastructure of the company, the committee, you know, the number of association that you support in order to push. That's also very important. And there's always, again, as I said earlier, you know, are you joining the European Asset Management Association, the global one? And then you have to talk to the chair of that association, make sure that he interacts with the other associations so that you know, everyone comes together. There's a lot of lobbying, a lot of discussions. It's quite a big job, actually. I mean, the amount of time dedicated to that now is, you know, if I think about our business development team, I mean, probably 50% of the time is focused on that, which it's a lot.
So is most of what you're seeing from investors on ESG climate-related? Or are you getting questions on social and governance stuff as well? Is it heavy climate or?
Yeah, I used to be heavily involved in our ILS activities, particularly our series of sidecars. And overwhelmingly, our investors and prospective investors were interested. Look, it's very pragmatic. They just wanted to be confident that we were at a handle on climate risk and were incorporating it properly, you know, in our portfolio construction and underwriting decisions and so forth. I mean, we are now receiving, I mean, probably like what you're referring to, Lorenzo, and we are receiving the occasional questionnaire from potential retrocessionaires, for example, who want to know, you know, not only about climate, but, you know, are you investing in tobacco? Do you invest in firearms? You know, alcohol?
Yeah.
One said adult activities, which I think we left out.
Which is great for us.
Yeah.
Because then we're going to ask those questions, right, as well, yeah, to our citizens. So yeah. For us, it's important that there is a proactive approach from every, you know, at every level of the chain. Otherwise, it's impossible, right?
But you guys, I mean, you said, I mean, it sounds like impact investing. I mean, ESG is sort of like a front end filter for a lot of your investors. Is that right, in Neuberger?
Yeah, it's definitely becoming that way. Some investors won't even consider a strategy if it's not ESG integrated. That's more so in Europe, I would say, than the U.S. But for ILS, I think our investors are more concerned about climate change and how we're addressing it and pricing it in. I think given the types of products we invest in, the index-based securities, they understand that, like with our parametrics, for example, we're able to tell if there's a payout immediately, we recognize the loss, and we send the money. So we're addressing that part. But to be more proactive, and kind of what we've been working on for the last 12 months, is the governance side of things and incorporating that into our investment process. So we have like a set of predetermined questions that we go through that cover E, S, and G, and we're assessing our counterparties based on these questions and, you know, looking to see if they are being proactive with their ESG initiatives, if they're launching any new ESG positive products and making any headway there. We're also concerned about, you know, reputation risk and, you know, making sure that they're contributing to this asset class in a positive way and long-term partners with us rather than, you know, being speculative, things like that.
Okay, so last question will come from me. I know this is a stretch, but where it looks like 22 is going to be the fourth consecutive year with industry-wide insured losses from political violence of multiple billions of dollars. And there are ESG implications from political violence. Do you think that the run of political violence we've seen and could very well continue to see will become an ESG issue for you, your company, your end investors? Or do you think that climate's going to wind up being enough for a while? I told you I'd get you something uncomfortable for you.
I think we need some good news at one point, right? I mean, it's, you're bringing in you know, additional worrying things that we haven't really thought about, right? It's definitely challenging. I mean, it goes down to penetration of insurance where you actually provide you know, one thing that I believe ILS manager are mostly focused on are, you know, developed countries where, you know, political riots. And I hear there are some situations where, you know, those have occurred in the US as well and so on. But then are we talking about big industry losses?
Well, US SRCC in 2020 was close to $3 billion. Chile in 19, close to $3 billion. South Africa last year, our informal numbers around 3.25.
Okay.
And then the PV from Ukraine, it's still too early to tell, but it's very likely to exceed South Africa.
Yeah, but, you know, South Africa and Ukraine, I mean, what is the penetration of insurance there, right? I mean, at the moment, I mean, obviously you're thinking going forward.
Well, South Africa is a $3+ billion.
Yeah, but across the ILS community?
No, I know. It's the low end of an aggressive franchise deductible.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that. Yeah, but what's interesting is before 2019, the thought of a multi-billion-dollar SRCC event was almost alien, kind of like the thought of a multi-billion-dollar wildfire event in 2015. And now, our imagination doesn't have to take us to $3 billion anymore because history has. So if your imagination takes you to a possible SRCC of $5, $6, or $10 billion, well, now you're getting to the upper end of Tor Hail, lower end of Hurricane. It starts to become something to worry about.
Sure, but I don't see our investors being worried about that risk for the moment, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I need to think that you don't want to surprise investors. But I understand. I mean, you're thinking, you know, like in a few years' time, you know, how this could impact the industry.
When the solar flare causes riots. So I'll turn things back to Steve. We don't touch cyber.
So that's,
not yet.
Not yet. Not yet.
Steve?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.